From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! A new film chronicles the life of South African President Nelson Mandela. We speak with his daughter, Zinzi.
My father says, I have always been a member of the African National Congress, and I will remain a member of the African National Congress until the day I die. I cannot and will not give any undertaking at a time when I and you, the people, are not free. Your freedom and mine cannot be separated.
Yale law students win the fight to stop their school from honoring F.W. de Klerk, and Anthony Lake takes a dive. He withdraws his candidacy for director of Central Intelligence. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton is expected to act swiftly to designate a new director of Central Intelligence after the sudden withdrawal of his first nominee for the post, former National Security Advisor Anthony Lake. Lake gave up the fight yesterday after 3 days of tough confirmation hearings last week, in which the Senate Intelligence Committee questioned his integrity, management skills, and fitness to head U.S. intelligence operations. One of Clinton's top advisors and architect of U.S. policy on Bosnia, Haiti, and Russia, Lake cited frustration over Republican efforts to turn his hearings into a, quote, political football in a game with constantly moving goalposts. Former White House senior advisor George Stephanopoulos said today he expects Clinton will soon nominate someone else for the top spy job. We'll have more on that story later in the show. A congressional group is renewing demands for an independent probe into the Army's ongoing sex scandal and said the military's tactics may have caused a recruit suicide. Recruits and drill sergeants met yesterday with a fact-finding delegation at the Aberdeen Proving Ground in Maryland. They confirmed reports of coercion by Army investigators, this according to Congressmember Maxine Waters of Los Angeles. Some recruits blame such tactics for the death of a private found hanged in his barracks January 4th, days before his scheduled court-martial on a charge of raping a female recruit, this again according to Congressmember Waters. Jury selection will begin as planned in the Oklahoma City bombing case, despite reports that suggest suspect Timothy McVeigh confessed. U.S. District Judge Richard Matsch said yesterday he has full confidence a fair-minded jury can be selected when the process begins March 31st. Applause erupted in a Los Angeles courtroom when prosecutors dismissed criminal charges against a patient with AIDS who used marijuana under a doctor's written diagnosis. Defense attorney John Duran said, "We just had something phenomenal happen. The city attorney had a change of heart." The dropping of drug possession charges against Willie Perkins was a key challenge to California's voter-approved medical marijuana law. Perkins was arrested December 8th while walking through a downtown neighborhood with a plastic bag of marijuana. Although he produced a letter from a doctor at Harbor UCLA Medical Center, it was not until yesterday that prosecutors made calls to verify the authenticity of the letter. This news from today's Daily News, that's the New York Daily News. 2 months after being slapped with a $300,000 fine for breaking House ethics rules, Speaker Newt Gingrich has asked staffers to come up with a way to pay, and dipping into his own pocket is not at the top of the list. In a telltale sign that the Georgia Republican doesn't want to be personally forking over the whopping fine, his office said yesterday he's asked aides to suggest other methods of payment. Gingrich also has directed staffers to ask the House Ethics Committee and Federal Election Commission whether it's okay for other House members to help pay it off. Additional possibilities include using campaign funds, establishing a legal defense fund, or paying it with his personal cash, which his wife, Marianne, opposes. We'd like your suggestions on how Newt Gingrich should pay this $300,000 fine. Why don't you give us a call on our comment line at 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. And in other Gingrich-related news, this from the Washington Post, House Speaker Newt Gingrich yesterday endorsed the idea of temporarily shelving the Republicans' drive for a major tax cut, adding his voice to a cacophony of GOP views on how best to achieve a balanced budget deal with President Clinton. Gingrich characterized his switch on tax cuts as a tactical retreat that would deprive liberals of their favorite objection in the balanced budget debate while leaving the GOP free to rejoin the campaign for lower taxes later. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Hillary Rodham Clinton began a three-day visit to South Africa today, saying the country still faces many challenges in the post-apartheid period, but that the United States is committed to helping. Clinton said in a statement issued as she and her daughter Chelsea arrived in Johannesburg after an all-night flight from the West African nation of Senegal, the solid partnership between South Africa and the United States is stronger than ever. During a day-long visit to Johannesburg and 2 days in Cape Town, President Clinton's wife, Hillary Rodham Clinton, said she was eager to witness firsthand the work being done to educate children, protect girls and women from violence, and build a non-racial, multi-ethnic society that will be an example to the world. A new film about South African President Nelson Mandela will open across the country later this month. Titled Mandela, the film chronicles the life of the former political prisoner turned president. Directed by South African filmmakers Joe Manel and Angus Gibson, the film is the only official biography of Nelson Mandela. And as a result, the filmmakers had unprecedented access to Mandela and to 100 hours of extraordinary archival footage.
Over 1,000 years ago, Africans migrated south. The Xhosa nation settled with their cattle in the eastern part of what is now called South Africa. European settlers arrived in the middle of the 17th century. They fought the Africans and drove them off their land, sowing the seeds of hatred that lasted for centuries. It was here in the Eastern Cape that Nelson Mandela was born in 1918. He was of royal blood, a descendant of Tembu chiefs, part of the Xhosa nation. He was called Rholihlahla Madiba Dalibunga Mandela.
When I went to school, the lady teacher, Miss Mdingane, asked, "What is your name?" I told him my African name, Rholihlahla. She says, "No, I don't want that one. You must have a Christian name." So I say, "No, I don't have one." She says, "You are, from today, you are going to be Nelson." That's how I earned the name Nelson. Not given by my parents. In fact, my mother, who has never gone to school, took me one day to a doctor. And the doctor asked, "Now, what is his name?" She said, "Nelisile." His name is Nelisile. Because it was a white name, you see, and they couldn't pronounce it properly.
Excerpt of the film Mandela being released around the country this month. Joining us to talk about the film, which premieres at a special benefit screening in New York City tonight, are the filmmakers Joe Menel and Angus Gibson. Also here in our studios is Zinzi Mandela, the daughter of South African President Nelson Mandela. And we welcome you all to Democracy Now!
Mm-hmm. Good to be here.
Hello.
Happy to be here.
Well, why don't we begin with the origins of this project and how you ended up being the only official film biographers of Nelson Mandela. Angus.
Well, this is actually an answer that Joe should give us.
Well, only because I was at a wedding, a family wedding, and met the president, Nelson Mandela, who was attending the wedding. And I asked him, I said, "I hear you're writing your autobiography." And he said, "Yes." And he was halfway or three quarters way through it. And I said, "Well, who's doing the film of your life?" And he said, "Nobody." And I couldn't believe this. I said, "There must be somebody out there making this film." And he said, "There wasn't." And I took a deep breath and said, "Well, I'd like to make it." This was 3 years, mind you, after he'd got out of prison, and still nobody was making the film. So it came about that way. It was simply just being in the right place at the right time, and we shook hands on it right there.
And when did you begin the project?
About 6 months after that. We took that time to get together the money and everything in place, and we started in October 93.
Well, let's talk about Nelson Mandela's life and where you begin the film. Actually, you begin it centuries ago. And then we're going to take it up to the time that Zinzi was born, and then she can take over, Nelson Mandela's daughter. Angus.
Well, we started right at the beginning because we felt that his roots are incredibly important and have sort of played a part very much in his whole life. He was born into a royal family. He was groomed as a chief. There was an expectation that he would become a chief. But in fact, in late adolescence, running away from a marriage, he went up to Johannesburg, and that kind of changed things there. But his grooming had been as a leader, and we felt that was incredibly important, and it's something that he talks pretty incredibly about. And I think there's an incredible intimacy. One learns an enormous amount about his early years in this film, which I think most people don't know about.
Zinzi, what did you learn about your father's early life, about how he was raised? How did he talk to you about it?
Well, most of it was actually, common knowledge, because despite the fact that he was away for many years, we would still as family, go like either during June or the December holidays to the Transkei, to the family graves, as is tradition. So, that part of it in the documentary wasn't new. It was just very refreshing to see, this other opinion and the way in which it was put together, the way in which it was documented. But he's always been somebody who's, really stood for, family, unity, holding the family together. That's, one important part of it.
Well, before you were born, Nelson Mandela was very politically active. Let's go back to the beginning. Nelson Mandela born in 1918. In 1927, his father passes away. In 1938, Nelson Mandela enrolled at the Hilltown Methodist Board School, went to the university, Fort Hare University College in the former Transkei, and there he met in 1939 Oliver Tambo, later president of the ANC. How significant was that meeting?
I think enormously. I think that Tambo and Mandela's meeting was the real rock base on which the African National Congress, which had already been in existence since 1912, but was something of a staid and conservative organization. And Tambo and Mandela's meeting then, they complemented each other in an extraordinary way. Tambo was a reflective, very philosophical, a strategist, a long-term thinker. Mandela was had an incredible presence and command. And when he walked in a room, even from a very young age, people turned around and looked at him. And these two, I think that sparked off something which later, meeting the third part of the triumvirate, which was Walter Sisulu, and that didn't come about for some years after that. But those three were, that was what the ANC, the whole change of the ANC and turning it into a revolutionary and a liberation organization took place then.
Might surprise some to know that when Nelson Mandela left Transkei and went to Johannesburg, he became a mine policeman and then met Walter Sisulu. Do you think of your father as a cop, Sensei?
As a night watchman, actually, like as a guard, not really a policeman, but somebody who was very much like there, to look after, the interests of the mine bosses at the mine. Just like pretty ironic, but you see, he's
long.
Very much, thank goodness, he was very much, you see, his life is very much a symbolic of the general experiences of South Africans as a whole. You speak to one South African and you talk about the things they've encountered and been through, and it's so many stories, in one.
Well, moving on from there, he established with Walter Sisulu the ANC Youth League in 1944. He served as the national secretary of ANCYL. Was it pronounced ANCYL? The ANC, the ANCYL. And then
Youth League.
Youth League.
The Youth League. And then in 1948, the official instatement of apartheid policy, soon after Mandela elected to the Youth League. How did things change in 1948 with the official instatement of apartheid?
I think it took a while for things to really change. You know, the new government came in, and it took them a number of years before they were actually sort of making their policy work for them. So there was a kind of a window in the early 50s where there was a kind of political activity which just stopped entirely in the 60s.
Yeah, Mandela says in the movie that he tells a story that as this government came in, he said to, was it Walter Sisulu?
Yeah.
He said, well, now at least we know we have our enemies in power. We now know who we're fighting, and this will help mobilize our people now that there is a truly racist. Before that, racism existed, but it wasn't openly written into the Constitution as such. There weren't the laws weren't obvious. They were just practiced under the cover. With the arrival of the Nationalist Party in 48, it was right out there in the open. It was a racist government, and Mandela took that as a good sign for the ANC.
In 1952, Nelson Mandela was arrested under the Suppression of Communism Act and sentenced to 9 months imprisonment, suspended for 2 years. He later served with banning orders, which effectively run for 9 years. What about that period of his life?
I'm trying to think, what about that period of his life? He was a lawyer at the time, and was a very, together with Oliver Tambo, it was the first black South African law firm. And I think he was very active as a lawyer. People described the waiting room as almost like a sort of doctor's waiting room. People wouldn't make appointments. They would just sort of turn up from the middle of nowhere with... And he was a very formidable figure in the courtroom. As a black... White South Africans did not expect to face a black South African like him with his kind of confidence and his willingness to confront white South Africans. So he was constantly a shock in the courtroom. And people would actually... come and apparently leave work when they knew that he was going to be in court, instead of literally just go and watch, you know, to see the kind of thing, you know, just see him in confrontational mode. And this was going on despite the fact he was banned. He was allowed to sort of travel for a day from Johannesburg, for example, but there was a constant police surveillance going on.
In 1956, he was arrested with more than 100 other activists and charged with high treason. Martial law was imposed in 1960, opposition banned. In 1961, Mandela was found not guilty of high treason. Following the failure of a three-day strike, he concludes with other senior ANC officials and the South African Communist Party that there's the need for the formation of a military wing. And subsequently, he was made commander-in-chief of that wing.
Well, this was, of course, a major turning point. Up until that moment, the ANC had been dedicated to a peaceful, democratic opposition. They realized it was getting nowhere, that the government would not allow them any participation in democracy and would just go on crushing and oppressing them. So that decision once made was a fateful decision, because in going underground and taking that job as head of the armed wing, Mandela knew he was putting himself beyond the law. And this, for a man who upheld the law as being sacred, realized in crossing that Rubicon, it was a major step in his life.
Now, this was 1961. Zinzi, when were you born?
I was born in 1960.
In 1960.
And I was 18 months old when he was sentenced to Robben Island.
Now, he was sentenced when he was captured with the ANC's underground military high command. In 1963, they implicated your father in the formulation of a revolutionary program, and he was sentenced in 1964. He wasn't around much even before then, because he was getting military training outside the country. What, do you remember the day that he was sentenced?
No, I don't, but my sister does, because she's a year older than me. She actually remembers, you know, like being there in court with my mother. She remembers seeing the police van driving away with him. I don't. I just remember the first time I got to see him, which is when I was about 15 years old.
Isn't it also true that the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency helped to locate Nelson Mandela for the South African regime so that they could pick him up?
It's strongly rumored. As in many things with the murky doings of the CIA, there isn't a memo or anything that one can, alas, have as concrete proof yet. Who knows? In the future, when they release more documents, maybe that'll be there. But it's known, it's generally believed to be so.
Well, we have to break, and when we come back, we also want to talk about, Zinzi, your life as a political activist and how your father, Nelson Mandela, has influenced you. We're talking to two filmmakers who have made a new film that is just opening around the country called Mandela. Our guests are Joe Mennel and as well as Angus Gibson, and we're joined by Nelson Mandela's daughter herself, Zinzi. We'll be back in 60 seconds. Sidlala izindugu, silusa izinkomo, sidlala ndawonye. Sakula sizingela. Sidlala izindugu, silusa izinkomo, sidlala ndawonye. Sakula sizingela. Sidlala izindugu, silusa izinkomo, sidlala ndawonye. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I am Amy Goodman, and we're continuing our discussion about South Africa. We're talking about a new film out. It's called Mandela. And we're joined by Joe Mennel and Angus Gibson, co-directors of Mandela, also Zinzi Mandela, the daughter of the South African president. Zinzi, talk about your life. Talk about your life with your father away on Robben's Island and how you became a political activist.
Well, obviously, from a very early age, I grew up very conscious of the fact that I did not have a father. And I got to understand from us, you know, similarly, when I was very young, that, you know, a greater cause had, you know, kept him, or rather had meant that he would be away for most of my life. But you see, as he always stresses, that he's a symbol of something greater. I cannot really say that had I been born, perhaps a Shabalala, that I may not have been politically active. One found oneself in, you know, like circumstances whereby one was forced to react, you know, to take some kind of action to be able to, you know, to guarantee that one would have, you know, a better life in future. And, you know, like I think as with many other young black South Africans, that's what made me decide to join the struggle.
Now, you were living with your mother.
Yes,
with
I
Winnie
was.
Mandela.
Yes.
So a lot of the time in your life, you were also kept in certain areas and banned.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you live?
When she was forcibly moved to exile in Brandfort, which is in the Orange Free State, and there was nothing free about it. This was in 1978. I lived with her there. And that was actually intended to break her completely. The way in which it was done and the way in which the people were very hostile when we got there, because they'd been thoroughly intimidated and warned, you know, about this communist witch who was going to be living amongst them. And, you know, they were threatened and told exactly what would happen to them in the event that they would, you know, if they were ever found speaking with her or visiting her. So she managed to, the one of her qualities is that she manages to turn, you know, negatives into positives. So she actually changed that whole environment. She changed Brandfort itself and made those people very militant in an area that is considered to be the kingdom of the Afrikaner.
You had how many brothers and sisters? Two others?
From my father's first marriage, I have two brothers and one sister, but my one brother died in 1968 in a car crash. And from my mother, it's just, you know, one sister and myself.
Mm-hmm. How much did you get to see your father? Did you ever get to see him?
We actually got to see much more when he was in prison than now. Because when he was in prison, we had this guarantee that we could see him at least twice a month legally. But now, because of the nature of his commitments and his schedule, obviously we cannot see him as often as we would like, but we obviously appreciate that he's got very important things to do and the time is so short.
Well, as he was in prison, he in fact was holding meetings and discussions with South African government representatives beginning in 1986. In 1989, in July, he met with then-President P.W. Botha. What about this meeting? Zinzi, do you remember it? Did you remember hearing?
Oh, when they started negotiating or planning the way in which he would be released or when he would be released. And it was during those discussions that an offer was made to my father to accept a conditional release, and which he defied.
In fact, we played the excerpt of the speech you gave then, reading
yes.
one of his statements.
Yeah, this is when he did say that he would give his response, to the public, because it became known that he had been offered this release, and that is how I came to read his response.
Where were you when you? Read
it
that.
Was at a place in Soweto called the Jabulani Stadium.
Well, he went from there. In 1990, President F.W. de Klerk announced the unbanning of political organizations like the ANC. And in that year, Nelson Mandela was released from prison after 27 years. Where were you on that day?
Well, I was there with my mother and I think about 40 other activists from the day of struggle. But you see, this is... I cannot really claim him as a father, of the family, my personal father alone, or my sister's father, just his four children. It's moments like those that tell you actually that, he remains very committed, to his people and very committed to his country.
How does that make you feel that you're sharing your father with so many millions?
Well, I've grown up knowing that I've had, I have to accept it. And I've had to, again, try to use that, for the best. I've had to say that I must learn, from his choices, from his sacrifices, a certain set of values which I can then, pass on to my own children and my children's children.
What are you doing today?
Today?
You live here or in South Africa?
No, I live in South Africa. I thought you were talking about the premier. I live in South Africa, and I am a businesswoman and a mother of five, and a wife, of course. Very heavy jobs, all in all.
Very serious jobs. In 1993, your father won the Nobel Peace Prize with F.W. de Klerk. Can you all talk about this? Because it was very controversial, the question of whether Nelson Mandela would receive this jointly with the man who had hurt so many of his people.
Well, not only hurt so many of his people, it was it had become known at that stage to Mandela that de Klerk had been lying to him, that de Klerk had said all along that he'd had nothing to do with any of the violence that had been going on, directed against everything from innocent commuters traveling in the trains from the townships or the ghettos into the city to blowing up of ANC party headquarters and all that. And de Klerk had denied down the line he knew this was absolutely nothing he had anything knowledge of or was involved in. Well, Mandela found out that was not true, and consequently, Mandela can't stand one thing more than anything else when people lie to him. So that was the end, effectively, of his relationship with de Klerk. But in the spirit of reconciliation, he decided he would accept the prize with de Klerk only because he was determined to cut a deal with the nationalists, with the racist government, to sit down at a table and to incorporate them into that election process and into a further government of national unity, i.e. whoever won the election, and it was pretty obvious the ANC would win, he was prepared to give a cabinet post to any other party that got more than 5% of the vote. And he felt that was the only way, by doing that, that he could take South Africa through this transitionary period into a new and democratic South Africa without major bloodshed. So with that in mind, he agreed to accept the prize with de Klerk. But he knew what de Klerk had been up to. And now, recently as the last 3 or 4 months, the real information of de Klerk and the previous president, Botha's, involvement in all this undercover, dirty war stuff is now becoming open knowledge to the world.
We're going to talk about that more in just a minute, because we're going to be joined by a student from the Yale Law School who has just helped succeed in making sure that F.W. de Klerk wasn't honored by Yale Law School. It's quite a significant event. Yale Law School has never revoked an invitation for this honor. F.W. de Klerk, when he heard about all of the uproar, which was actually initiated by a number of South African students at Yale, he decided to not show up at Yale and write a letter saying he would not be receiving the honor. But Zinzi, what did you think at the time? What did you think about your father working with F.W. de Klerk?
Well, I was like in a more privileged position to know already, what my father was working towards. I must say that for many of South Africa's black youth, it took, quite a lot for them to understand this whole spirit of reconciliation, that in a sense the country had to be saved. From some kind of like total destruction and war, and the economy had to be saved, and we had to keep, all the skilled people in the country with the capital, and then within that type of atmosphere, find ways of shaping our lives, and initiating the reconstruction and development policy.
The Truth and Reconciliation Commission is not getting a lot of attention here in the United States, but it's explosive. I mean, the fact that you have these killers who are coming forward, you have these men who might be tried. In fact, when prosecutors go after them, they run to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission so they can get amnesty. I don't know if we've seen this anywhere where one after another they're describing their crimes, although in the end they're getting amnesty. What do you think about this?
Well, I think it is very important that, as a beginning, that people should be coming forward to have, their mistakes and those particularly horrendous crimes recorded and brought to the attention of the world as a whole. I think it's very important because there is a belief that if you record, mistakes that were made in the past, then it's that much easier to move ahead and avoid repeating those same mistakes, for the generations to come. And the majority of black people who have been participating in the hearings or who have been affected by the confessors, to the crimes concerned, the majority of those people you find actually say, all that I want at this stage is just to know where my son or my husband's, body lies so that I can at least get him back and give him a decent burial. All I just need to know who committed the crime, and I need to know, how I can best, give him dignity even in death.
You have Stephen Biko's family, who is completely rejecting the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Now we've learned from those who are testifying that perhaps he wasn't just bludgeoned to death, that they injected him with a poison that made him look like he had just been bludgeoned. But they don't want anything to do with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission because they want his murderers to be brought to justice.
Well, it's a very real argument, and I have personally enormous sympathy with those people that want due process. They want the murderers to be brought into a court, allowed a defense, and to stand trial, and if convicted, to suffer the severest penalty. Now, it's also important to say that one of the first acts the African National Congress did was to abolish the death sentence in South Africa. This was a country that actually executed more people per capita than Russia or the United States, the other two top contenders in that dubious award category.
And it's an issue that we certainly have taken on here in Democracy Now!, the issue of the death penalty. In the last few weeks, playing the commentaries of Mumia Abu-Jamal, a death row inmate in Pennsylvania, whom actually Nelson Mandela has written about and spoken about. Well, I want to thank you all very much for joining us. Again, the film that we're talking about and the man that we're talking about is called Mandela, the film Mandela, Son of Africa, Father of a Nation. We'd like to thank the daughter of this father of a nation. We'd like to thank Zinzi for joining us, Zinzi Mandela, for being with us this morning. And we'd also like to thank the filmmakers who have done this opus that is being aired or brought Not Really Broadcast, was opening around the country this week. Joe Mennel, thanks for joining us, co-director of Mandela, once banned from working in South Africa because of a television series he produced there. And Angus Gibson, co-director also of Mandela, made anti-apartheid films and social documentaries in South Africa during the 1980s. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
Got a special interest in all students, all teachers in this country. It is absolutely important that you have the knowledge to serve your country and your people.
The people's president was taken away.
Don't push us too far. Don't push us too far.
And that was F.W. de Klerk. That short clip, also from the film Mandela, Son of Africa, Father of a Nation. And we're going to talk for a few minutes about F.W. de Klerk, because the Yale Law School last year decided to honor former South African President F.W. de Klerk with one of the school's most prestigious fellowships, the Fowler Harper Memorial Fund. The fellowship is given to those who, in the opinion of the school's faculty, have made a distinguished contribution to public life, and the recipients are then feted at the school for 3 days in April. That would have been this April. But this year, students mounted protests against the decision to honor F.W. de Klerk, especially as evidence mounted in South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission hearings about top-level complicity in atrocities carried out by the former white-only government against anti-apartheid activists. Here to update us on the recent developments at Yale Law School is Richard Bury, third-year law student at Yale and member of the Black Law Students Association. Richard, welcome back to Democracy Now! When we spoke to you last, at the time you were fighting the honoring of F.W. de Klerk, what's happened?
Well, what happened is a lot of students spent a lot of time harassing a lot of faculty members. And eventually the dean and some members of the faculty decided that it would be inappropriate to go ahead with this honor at this time. When the dean contacted Mr. de Klerk to relay that information, Mr. de Klerk, before the dean could state his opinion and postpone the honor, Mr. de Klerk decided to pull out. Obviously, he didn't want to deal with us. I mean, he didn't want to come here and deal with the protests and deal with the tough questions that we would have asked him. I guess he would only have come for a party. He wasn't willing to come to actually talk and answer questions.
According to the letter that I read that he wrote to Yale, he said he was voluntarily pulling out because he had read the reports in South Africa about the uproar that had been created at Yale Law School. And he talked about the Yale students, particularly he commented on some who were from South Africa who had an agenda and who alleged that he, quote, had been head of a, and again, he said, quote, a racist regime.
Right. Like I said, he voluntarily withdrew before Dean Kronman even had a chance to say that it wouldn't be appropriate for him to come in April. That letter is a very odd letter. I'm not quite sure what to make of those quotes. He basically goes on to say, I think in the letter, that that allegation is untrue. I suppose he's saying that he would not have a racist white government. But we're glad that things have worked out the way that they have. I would have welcomed the opportunity to ask him some questions and have him defend himself and have him be embarrassed. But I am glad that he is not going to be receiving the fellowship. I'm still unhappy that it had to happen this way. It's still very odd to me that the faculty even could have done this in the first place. But I'm glad of the way it's worked out.
Has it led to some questioning of how this honor is chosen? I know that when the students started to speak out, you at the law school, a close friend of Fowler Harper, for whom the Memorial Fund is named, said that he would have been spinning in his grave if he heard that this Memorial Fund in honor of Fowler Harper was being used to honor de Klerk.
Correct. I mean, I hope so. To be honest, I'm a little pessimistic. I think the faculty, and I'm sure this is not unique to Yale, the way the faculty works, basically the faculty works by itself. I mean, it goes into rooms and decisions are made, and then they come out. So I'm not sure if this means that it'll mean any increase in student or community participation in the decisions. I am skeptical that would ever happen. I would hope at least that this would cause people on the faculty to think twice before making any decisions, at the very least, to question, to be considerate, at least to ask other people's opinions before it makes decisions like this. I mean, 99% of the time, I'm sure those decisions are uncontroversial, and way beyond controversial, but hopefully this will at least get them just to take stock the 1% of the time and to think about how people will feel, how their actions affect people, before they decide to act in this way.
Well, Richard Bury, I want to thank you for updating us on the situation, and it's nice to hear that it has been resolved. Again, F.W. de Klerk will not be honored by Yale Law School this year because of the students at the Yale Law School. Richard Bury, a third-year law student at Yale and member of the Black Law Students Association. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, and thank you for taking the time to help us out.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Okay.
When we come back, we're going to turn to a very different issue, and that is the decision of the nominee for Director of Central Intelligence, Anthony Lake, his decision to drop out and to withdraw his candidacy for that position. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman. In a stunning development yesterday afternoon, President Clinton's nominee to lead Central Intelligence withdrew his candidacy. Anthony Lake, who had already gone through 3 days of confirmation hearings before the Senate Intelligence Committee, reportedly told President Clinton he was sick of being a dancing bear in a political circus. Here to discuss the situation and the CIA nominee are Lou Wolf, who is co-founder of Covert Action Quarterly, and Larry Bensky joins us from Berkeley, from our Pacifica station KPFA. He's Pacifica Radio's national affairs correspondent. Welcome both to Democracy Now! Lou, your response to this late-breaking news.
Well, it was quite interesting and surprising in the way it came down. I must say that some of us thought that he wasn't going to get the confirmation in the first place because of the what we generally call the Old Boy Network, and it does seem, in fact, that the Old Boy Network was very active in behind the scenes in this. There's every indication that not only what took place in the public hearings, but also last Thursday in the closed secret hearing, and then over the weekend, there was a lot of activity in here in Washington, and part of it was reflected in an article that apparently was placed, strategically placed yesterday in the Wall Street Journal, and subsequent stories about that case, if you want, we can discuss it. But essentially, I think the decision was in even before last week.
Explain the article.
Torpedo the. Well, it's a story about one Roger Tamraz, who is a Lebanese oil man who had relations with the CIA at least back to the 1980s. And he wanted to build a 930-mile oil pipeline from the Caspian Sea to Turkey through Armenia and Azerbaijan. And he apparently had support from some sectors in the U.S., including in the National Security Council. But at some point, he, in seeking, he contributed $177,000 to the Democratic National Committee and was given at least four occasions access to the White House and indeed to President Clinton. June 1996, they sat and watched the film Independence Day together in the White House. Of course, some people are saying this doesn't reflect on Lake. I think there are some questions about how the NSC staff, which recommended against Tamraz having this access to the White House, and indeed there was a CIA report on Tamraz provided against security regulations at the CIA, was provided, and that has raised a lot of questions as well.
Larry Bensky, your comments today, just, a number of hours after the announcement that Anthony Lake would withdraw his candidacy as director of Central Intelligence.
I wasn't really surprised, Amy, when you and I first found out about this yesterday. I think I said that it seemed to me a kind of a logical consequence of the process that was going on. Lake is a proud, if not arrogant, guy. He saw that what he was really being judged on had nothing to do with his capability of running the CIA or even his ideas about the CIA, but more with some very old agendas and very base-type Washington politics, agendas dating back to the Second World War and whether he thought Alger Hiss was guilty and the Rosenbergs and all of that dragged up in the hearings, but as well the entire bloodlust that goes on in Washington when a politician like Bill Clinton is perceived to be weak and a politician like Richard Shelby with no principles and basically nothing to lose decides to try to make a career move out of another politician's weakness. This is not the kind of thing that a kind of a reserved and distanced person like Anthony Lake really thought he needed or wanted to go through any further. And I think he just had enough of it. I think it probably came to a head at a time that we won't know about for a while, if ever, and that is the closed hearing that happened last Thursday. Listeners will remember that the three of us were involved in the broadcast of the first 2 days of the hearings, and then the third day on Thursday they were mostly in closed session, and I think at that point there were probably some free and frank ideas where, for example, Senator Inhofe, one of the far-right senators on this committee, probably told Lake that he was going to filibuster his nomination. Inhofe repeated that in a small sidebar story in the New York Times today. And I just don't think that Lake needed this or wanted it or felt, frankly, that he was going to serve an administration where he was going to get much backing in this.
You know, one of the things we talked about during the live broadcast of the the Intelligence Committee hearings on Anthony Lake was the lack of discussion of what, in fact, the agency does, the CIA, as well as the larger agency, the National Security Agency, and how little light was shed, in fact, in those open hearings on exactly what Anthony Lake or whoever will be the next nominee, what they would be in charge of if confirmed. Lou, let's talk a little about that. I also wanted to point out that in the front page of the New York Times today, there's a piece by Tim Weiner, says CIA to examine possible links of agency to Democratic Party. And it goes on to say the Central Intelligence Agency has opened an internal investigation into extremely serious allegations of improper contacts between the Democratic National Committee and the CIA, the acting director of Central Intelligence, said today. The investigation, begun 4 days ago by the agency's inspector general, seeks to unravel a tangled chain of events that preceded President Clinton's meetings with Roger Tamraz, a big campaign contributor who has done favors for the CIA, just what you were talking about, Lou.
Well, it does raise a lot of questions about not only the Democratic National Committee and its involvements through its head person, Donald Fowler, but also the long and rather secret history of the CIA's role in domestic politics. You know, we have the belief, the conventional wisdom, that the CIA only operates overseas. I'm afraid people should start realizing that they're quite active here in the United States. One of the senators actually went and sent one of his staff members over, in this case, to the National Security Agency, totally unprecedented, to gather information supposedly on Lake. This was one of a number of elements that Lake learned about over the weekend, which made him finally withdraw. There's also the fact that the people that at the DO, the Director of Operations, who are basically behind this, with Senators Imhoff, Senator Kyle, and Senator Shelby as their basically spokespeople in this operation.
Explain the significance of the Directorate of Operations and what role it plays in the CIA.
Those are the covert action people.
Right. And explain how they would be the ones that could torpedo Lake.
Well, they seem to see him as somebody they can't trust. He's not one of them. They see themselves, and I think there's every indication that it's operated here, as the guardians of the family jewels at the CIA, or that the CIA is the family jewel, the family being the intelligence family, if you will. And they aren't prepared to accept an outsider like this. There have been so many outsiders recently, and that has caused untold damage at the CIA and loss of morale. It's not just Aldrich Ames that did it. It's been the direction of the CIA, the sailing boat, as it were, adrift in a large ocean. But I guess, as a friend suggested to me, we can't expect any leaks from a lake. And I think Tony Lake saw himself, as he was quoted saying last week in the New York Times, "I just can't think of a more interesting job in government. I hate to be bored, and God knows this isn't boring." Well, here's the man who was national security advisor for 4 years. Perhaps he was bored there. I don't know. But this job, director not only of the CIA, but of the entire intelligence apparatus and, you know, the long list of agencies, and the CIA being at the head of the pack, basically is a huge job, and it has tremendous responsibility and tremendous secrecy, to say nothing of the fact that Tony Lake announced at the hearing that one of his four missions that he saw himself taking on was to demystify the CIA to the American people, basically to become a public relations man for the CIA.
Of course, that's an impossible job, because what he would have had to demystify is all of the illegal, unethical, and indeed murderous activities that the CIA has undertaken over the years, and no doubt still has under its wing in various places where countries, elections, individuals, governments are ripe for destabilization. Anybody who wants to really read about the culture of the CIA should read Duane Dewey Claridge's recent autobiography. And the idea of Lake not being tough enough for the job is, Amy, as you were, I think, quite graphically pointing out during the hearings last week, ludicrous. I mean, this was a man who thought nothing of intervening in the Haiti process on the side of repressive forces there. We don't know what his other activities were in the National Security Council, of course, because there's very little good journalism by the establishment press about it. But is there the evidence that the Clinton administration has gone along just as much as the Bush and Reagan administration with all kinds of covert activities inside the CIA? And here even Tony Lake wasn't tough enough for them. I think the answer basically lies in what I was talking about before a perceived political weakness in the most base sense of the term in the Clinton administration these days and in Bill Clinton as president, where the Republicans really feel they can get away with whatever they want, especially in the Senate, where Trent Lott is not running a very tight ship, but also now in the House, where Newt Gingrich has been significantly weakened. And so the right wing, which has all of the political energy behind it in the Republican Party, feels free to take over. And we saw the kind of ludicrous posturing that we had last week on the part, as Lou said, of Senators Shelby, Kyle, and Inhofe especially, but also some of the other right-wing Republicans on the committee. And finally, I think this sets a very dangerous precedent now in the rest of the Clinton administration years as president for other nominations in other areas, such as, for example, the Supreme Court, where there may be one, two, or three vacancies this term. If President Clinton has so little political muscle and so little finesse still that he can't get through somebody who seems qualified for the job like Anthony Lake into a job that Lake would seem to be fit for, then you have to wonder what kind of battles are coming up down the road.
We have to also comment that Alexis Herman, her hearings begin today as she tries to attain the job of Secretary of Labor. But one more point on the Central Intelligence Agency. Yesterday, the House Intelligence Committee cleared the CIA of involvement in the killing in Guatemala of an American and a Guatemalan guerrilla leader married to an American lawyer. The charge was made 2 years ago by New Jersey Democratic Senator Robert Torricelli, then a member of the House. Torricelli, in a letter to Clinton and in public statements, accused the CIA of direct involvement in the 1990 murder of American Michael Devine, who ran a hotel in Guatemala, and Efraín Bámica Velásquez, who disappeared while a prisoner of the Guatemalan military in 92. The Bámica case became a cause célèbre when his widow, Jennifer Harbury, a Harvard Law School graduate, conducted hunger strikes to try to learn the truth about his disappearance. We heard from Jennifer just a few days ago on Democracy Now! And during the hearings that we broadcast live from the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing room. Well, Torricelli, then a member of the Intelligence Committee, said the CIA found out the killings were ordered by a Guatemalan colonel on its payroll, but concealed its knowledge. Now, the majority report on its 18-month investigation, the House committee said there's no evidence to support the allegations that U.S. government personnel in any way directed or participated in the Devine death or the capture, interrogation, or subsequent disappearance of Bámica.
But that's really quibbling. I mean, they're playing language games there, because also in that report they say several CIA assets were credibly alleged to have ordered, planned, or participated in serious human rights violations such as assassination, extrajudicial execution, torture, or kidnapping while they were assets, and that the CIA was contemporaneously aware of many of these allegations. In other words, they did it, but they didn't do it. That's the conclusion of this report.
That's right. Well, a minority report, four of the committee's Democrats say they didn't agree with the statement, saying it wasn't supported by the evidence the committee had seen. Lou, we have just about 30 seconds.
Well, perhaps now, I guess the bottom line is that Bámica tortured himself to death and Michael Devine decapitated himself. And that's the end of story.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Lou Wolfe, co-founder of Covert Action Quarterly, and also Larry Bensky, Pacifica National Affairs correspondent. Lou joining us from Washington and Larry joining us from out in Berkeley. I want to let people know who've been following the story of the Mumia Abu-Jamal commentaries that today at noon Eastern Standard Time, Temple University Law School is holding a forum on censorship. One professor is, and he's pressing the university to step down on them, demanding he pay $1,000 for security. He says this is a form of intimidation that he won't stand for. We're going down to Philadelphia, and we'll let you know what happens tomorrow. We'll be playing some of the speeches there. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin and Errol Maitland. Our engineer today, Errol Maitland in New York, and Ken Mason in Washington, D.C. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!